This is not what I call religion, this profession and assertion, which is often only a profession and assertion from the outworks of the man, from the mere argumentative region of him, if even so deep as that. But the thing a man does practically believe, and this is often enough without asserting it even to himself, much less to others, the thing a man does practically lay to heart and know for certain concerning his vital relations to this mysterious universe and his duty and destiny there, that is in all cases the primary thing for him, and creatively determines all the rest. That is his religion, or it may be his mere skepticism and no religion. The manner it is in which he feels himself to be spiritually related to the unseen world or no world. And I say, if you tell me what that is, you tell me, to a very great extent, what the man is, what the kind of things he will do is. End quote. Thomas Carlyle, On Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History. Reducing masculinity to a handful of tactical virtues may seem crude, thuggish, and uncivilized. What about moral virtue? What about justice, humility, charity, faith, righteousness, honesty, and temperance? Aren't these manly virtues too? Men aren't heartless monsters, and they aren't machines. Men think about more than hunting and killing and defending. Men are capable of compassion as well as cruelty. Thinking men ask why. It's not always enough to win. Men want to believe that they are right and that their enemies are wrong. To separate us from them, men find moral fault in their enemies and create codes of conduct to distinguish themselves as good men. One of the finest examples of this is the Christian knight, an ascetic committed to piety and violence, fighting in shining armor for goodness with God on his side. Most men would agree that it is better to be a good man who stands up to bad men. They would rather be heroes than villains. Most men want to see themselves as good men fighting for something greater than survival or gain. When you ask men about what makes a real man, a lot of them will get up on their high horses and start talking about what it means to be a good man. A real man would never hit a woman. A man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man. A real man takes responsibility for his actions. A real man pays his debts. Real men love Jesus. However, if you ask the same men to list their favorite guy movies, many of them will include films like The Godfather, Scarface, Goodfellas, and Fight Club. Don Corleone, Tommy DeVito, and Henry Hill were all ruthless racketeers. Scarface was a murdering drug lord. Tyler Durden was basically a domestic terrorist. There are scores of popular gang and heist flicks, among them Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13, Snatch, Smoking Aces, The Italian Job, Heat, Ronin, The Sting, The Usual Suspects, Reservoir Dogs, and Pulp Fiction. The calculating, morally ambiguous hitman for hire has found an especially sympathetic place in the cinematic pantheon of manliness. The Professional, The Matador, In Bruges, The Mechanic, The American, Collateral, Road to Perdition, No Country for Old Men. Hitman was both a film and a video game. Two of the best-selling video game franchises during the last decade were Assassin's Creed and Grand Theft Auto. Sons of Anarchy, a show about a motorcycle gang, is popular on television. Are its characters unmanly because they are outlaws? What about Tony from The Sopranos, or Al Swearengen from Deadwood? Was Darth Vader a pussy? Despite the moral posturing, Men are attracted to these characters precisely because they are manly. Bad guys tend to operate in brutal, indelicate, and unmoderated boys' clubs, and they seem to be particularly concerned with the business of being men. Gangsters are status-conscious, aggressive, tactically oriented, ballsy, brother-bonded men's men. The loner hitmen are portrayed as capable, but smooth, careful operators who are masters of their dangerous craft. They are not good men, but they are good at doing the kinds of things that have been demanded of men throughout human history. They are not good men, but they are good at being men. Before film, men and boys were thrilled by tales of outlaws, pirates, highwaymen, and thieves. Whether these stories were romanticized or spun as cautionary tales, they captured the male imagination with adventurous accounts of daring and mischievous virility. In Shakespeare's The Life of Henry V, the king promised his enemies that unless they surrendered, his men would rape their shrieking daughters, dash the heads of their old men, and impale their naked babies on pikes. Today, if a military leader made a promise so indelicate, he would be fired and publicly denounced as an evil, broken psychopath. I can't call Henry an unmanly character with a straight face. Consider also the case of the prisoner. Do you truly believe that men who negotiate a violent, all-male world every day are less manly than a nice guy who works 9 to 5 in a cubicle farm and spends his free time doing whatever his wife tells him to do? What about suicide bombers? I'd say that hijacking a plane with a box knife and flying it into a building takes balls of steel. I don't have to like it. But if I'm being honest with myself, I can't call those guys unmanly. Enemies of my tribe, yes. Unmanly, no. Remember that there are hundreds of thousands of men and boys who regard suicide bombers as brave, martyred heroes who took substantial risks and made the ultimate sacrifice for a cause. We think of them as evil and flatter ourselves by calling them cowardly because they aren't on our team, because they don't share all of our values, and because they endanger our collective interests. We want our external enemies to be defective and unsympathetic. Many have written about our tendency to dehumanize our foes. Emasculating them is another aspect of that. It adds insult to injury. We also want to puff ourselves up and psych them out. It's a good strategy. Insulting a man's honor, his masculine identity, is a good way to test him. It's a good way to get his blood up. It's a good way to pick a fight. We want our villains within to be equally unsympathetic. Portraying bad men as unmanly men is a good way to dissuade young men from behaving badly. Making your own cultural heroes seem bigger than life elevates group pride and morale. It makes sense to want your young men to emulate men who champion your people's values, and young men especially tend to choose the stronger horse. Cultures have wrestled with the idea of what it means to be a good man for thousands of years. Waller R. Newell, a professor of political science and philosophy, collected a broad range of thinking on the topic for his book, What is a Man? 3,000 Years of Wisdom on the Art of Manly Virtue. Newell criticized those who came of age in the 1960s for establishing a cultural orthodoxy prone to believing that nothing just, good, or true had happened before their time, and for causing, quote, the disappearance of the positive tradition of manliness through relentless simplification and caricature, end quote. He showed what he referred to as, quote, an unbroken pedigree in the Western conception of what it means to be a man, end quote, which he defined as, quote, honor tempered by prudence, ambition tempered by compassion for the suffering and the oppressed, love restrained by delicacy, and honor toward the beloved. End quote. His source book was filled with selections from Plato, Aristotle, Marcus Aurelius, Francis Bacon, Geoffrey Chaucer, William Shakespeare, Benjamin Franklin, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Winston Churchill, John F. Kennedy, and many others. There is a movement to reclaim this idea of virtuous manhood, to show young men how to be good and manly men. In 2009, venture capitalist Tom Matlick started a four-pronged effort to foster a discussion about manhood called the Good Men Project. The Good Men Project currently exists as a foundation, an online magazine, a documentary film, and a book. The book is filled with stories of men who are struggling to be good men in the 21st century and trying to figure out what that means. The Art of Manliness website was founded by Brett McKay and his wife, Kate, in 2008, and boasts some 90,000 subscribers. The McKays have published two books, offering their take on the subject of manliness. The Art of Manliness, Classic Skills and Manners for the Modern Man, and The Art of Manliness, Manvotionals, Timeless Wisdom and Advice on Living the Seven Manly Virtues. The site itself reveres good, manly historical figures like Rough Rider, Theodore Roosevelt, and it has a nostalgic feel to it. It's a bit like a Boy Scout handbook for adult males, offering advice and how-to articles to help out men who are trying to be good protectors, providers, husbands, and fathers. An Art of Manliness workout isn't just a workout, it becomes hero training. I asked Brett McKay what he thought the difference was between being a good man and being good at being a man. He said that being good at being a man means, quote, being proficient in your ability to earn and keep your culture's idea of manhood, end quote. He elaborated, noting that while there were cross-cultural similarities, quote, being good at being a man for the Kalahari Bushmen means being able to be persistent and hunt successfully. Being good at being a man for a man living in suburban Ohio probably means holding down a job to support a family, being able to fix things around the house, or if he is single, being adept at interacting with women. End quote. McKay told me he thought being a good man was simpler. He wrote, quote, developing virtues like honesty, resilience, courage, compassion, discipline, justice, temperance, etc. A man can be a very virtuous and upright man, but can be horrible at being a good man. Maybe he can't hunt, or he's terrible around women, or he can't use a hammer to save his life. It's also possible to have a man who's good at being a man, but isn't a good man. You can be the best hunter or mechanic in the world, but if you lie, cheat, steal, you're not a good man. End quote. McKay seemed to say that being good at being a man is like fulfilling a job description, defined by what your culture needs or wants men to do. And being a good man has more to do with the kind of moral virtues that Newell advocated. A man can fail at the job of being a man, but still be a good person. I use person here because these moral values are fairly gender neutral. Perhaps along these lines of thinking, being a good man is a matter of balancing the cultural demands of manhood with a private commitment to moral uprightness. McKay's positive prescription for manliness is a welcome change from mainstream men's magazines, which are more interested in creating sociopathic, metrosexual superconsumers than writing positively about manhood. I'd agree with McKay that being good at being a man is rather like a job description, and that the description changes a great deal from culture to culture. However, stopping there plays into the hands of those who say that being a man can mean anything anyone wants it to mean. Is manliness so flexible a concept that a community can rewrite the job description however they wish? Not if we accept any model of human nature that acknowledges differences between male and female psychology. Over the past few decades, Americans have transitioned to a service economy and educators treated boys like naughty little girls with attitude problems. Males have become less interested in educational achievement, less engaged in political life, less concerned about careers, and more interested in forms of entertainment that feature vicarious gang drama, like video games and spectator sports. Further, if the job description of being a man is written in such a way that the qualities which make a good man are basically identical to the qualities that make a good woman, then those qualities are more about being a good person than anything else. It is good to be honest, just, and kind, but these virtues don't have much specifically to do with being a man. Manliness can't merely be synonymous with good behavior. I was raised by a decent family in rural Pennsylvania. I went to Sunday school. I was taught to be polite and respectful to others. I overtip even when I get crappy service in restaurants. I hold doors for little old ladies, and I'm honest to a fault. When I treat people poorly, I feel bad about it, unless they really had it coming. Like many men, I rebelled against my parents' values when I was younger. However, perhaps like Brett McKay or Tom Matlick, when I later began thinking seriously about masculinity and what it meant, the following phrase kept popping into my head. I can't think of anything better to be than a good man. I still can't. My first attempts to describe the value of traditional masculinity in print were laced with the kind of homespun morality I grew up with. I respect men who try their damnedest to be good men, even when I don't agree with them concerning every little detail about what that means. A lot of men choose careers in law enforcement, firefighting, teaching, or even the military because they truly want to be good men. Wars, laws, and policies aren't always just, but I have to tip my hat to the men who rescue civilians and pull kids out of burning buildings. Only broken hysterics refer to all soldiers and cops as cannon fodder, or pigs, or tools. However, unless self-sacrifice and restraint are to be masculinity's defining qualities, unless masculinity is to be an ascetic discipline and nothing more, there is a point, somewhere down a road of diminishing returns, that being a good man is no longer a good trade. There's a point where a man who wants to feel useful ends up feeling used. When the system no longer offers men what they want, how long can you expect them to perform tricks for a pat on the head? How long? Until the neglected, starving dog turns on its master. I agree with Newell that there is a long, proud tradition of moral masculinity in the West, and from what I can gather, there are comparable traditions in the East. Muslim men pray 5 times a day because they, too, want to be good men in their own way. However, Newell's pitch itself contains a built-in duality. Honor, tempered by prudence. Ambition, tempered by compassion for the suffering and the oppressed, love restrained by delicacy, and so forth. Civilized, religious, and secular attempts to show men how to be good men all seem to include these kinds of checks and balances. These good man codes tell men to be manly, but not too manly. They advocate restraint. Restraint of what? It seems as though in one hand we have morality, and in the other we have something else. A kind of maleness that must be guarded against. If we allow the moralizers of masculinity to define masculinity for us, we either give ourselves over to the one true code of masculinity and become completely ethnocentric about it, which would be the historical norm, or we end up with an endless number of masculinities, get bogged down in the details of their myriad contradictions, and declare, as one famous transgendered sociologist has, quote, that masculinity is not a coherent object about which a generalizing science can be produced. End quote. It is true that if a word or concept can mean anything, it means nothing. Raywin Bob Connell wrote that, quote, claims about a universal basis of masculinity tell us more about the ethos of the claimant than anything else, end quote. Connell was a feminist pacifist who advocated the degendering of society, as well as a man who wanted to become a woman. He eventually degendered himself. His claims about the non-existence of a universal basis of masculinity also revealed his own ethos. All men and women have emotional and material interests when it comes to how masculinity is constructed or deconstructed. True objectivity on this subject is a more or less successful pose. We all have a horse in the race. For whatever it is worth, scientific evidence for biological differences between the sexes and cross-cultural commonalities between men has continued to build since Connell published Masculinities in 1995. And it is not difficult to find repeated themes in the hegemonic masculinities of cultures across the world and throughout history. It is far more difficult to find masculinities that have nothing in common. Technologies and customs vary, but the similarities between cultural ideas of manhood offer more in the way of explaining what it means to be good at being a man than the ephemeral differences. What they have in common has more to do with the gang, with hunting and fighting, with drawing and defending the boundary between us and them, than it has to do with any culturally specific moral or ethical system. It's dishonest to pretend that men who don't meet a given set of moral standards are unmanly men. Men may say that immoral men are not real men, but their behavior, including the public admiration for the virility of roguish and criminal types, shows that they don't quite believe this. To truly understand the way of men, we must look for where the masculinity of the gangster overlaps with the masculinity of the chivalrous knight, where modern ideas overlap with ancient ones. We must look at the phenomenon of masculinity amorally and as dispassionately as we can. We must find what man knows for certain concerning his vital relations to this mysterious universe. The religion of man is not a moral code, though a man may follow his own code to his death. A man struggles to maintain his personal honor, his reputation as a man, because some part of him is struggling to earn and maintain a position of value, his status and his sense of belonging within the primal gang. Men want to be good men because good men are well regarded. But being a good man isn't the same as being good at being a man. There is a difference between being a good man and being good at being a man. Being a good man has to do with ideas about morality, ethics, religion, and behaving productively within a given civilizational structure. Being a good man may or may not have anything at all to do with the natural role of men in a survival scenario. It is possible to be a good man without being particularly good at being a man. This is an area where men who were good at being men have sought counsel from priests, philosophers, shamans, writers, and historians. The productive synergy between these kinds of men is sadly lost when men of words and ideas pit themselves against men of action or vice versa. Men of ideas and men of action have much to learn from each other, and the truly great men are men of both action and abstraction. Being good at being a man is about being willing and able to fulfill the natural role of men in a survival scenario. Being good at being a man is about showing other men that you are the kind of guy they'd want on their team if the shit hits the fan. Being good at being a man isn't a quest for moral perfection. It's about fighting to survive. Good men admire or respect bad men when they demonstrate strength, courage, mastery, or a commitment to the men of their own renegade tribes. A concern with being good at being a man is what good guys and bad guys have in common. Given enough time, every gang will create some sort of moral code or system of rules to govern its members. Men want to believe that they are in the right, and they distinguish themselves by cobbling together some idea of what it means to be right. In early mafia culture, honor meant loyalty more important than blood ties. Mobsters swore not to make money from prostitution or sleep with each other's wives. They were expected to be family men and were discouraged from womanizing. If the quote, "a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man," seemed familiar, that's because it was from The Godfather. Yakuza gangs modeled themselves after samurai and increased their social standing within the larger community by showing generosity and compassion toward the weak and disadvantaged. One Mexican gang, known as La Familia Michoacana, recently preached family values, passed out their own version of the Bible, and used some of their profits to help the poor. The leaders of La Familia are known to have been influenced by the macho Christian writing of contemporary American author John Eldridge. In dire times, men who are not good at being men won't last long enough to worry about being good men. Strength makes all other values possible. As Han said in Enter the Dragon, "Who knows what delicate wonders have died out of the world for want of the strength to survive?" Men who have accomplished the first job of being men, men who have made survival possible, can and do often concern themselves with being good men. As the bloody boundary between threat and safety moves outward, men have the time and the luxury to cultivate civilized, higher virtues. Gangs of men with separate identities and interests of their own are always a threat to established interests. To protect the interests of those who run our civilized, highly regulated world, men and women are mixed to discourage gang formation. Feminists, pacifists, and members of the privileged classes recognize that brother-bonded men who are good at being men will always be a threat, but forget that some of those men are necessary to create and maintain order in the first place. There is a call to do away with what even the United Nations has deemed outmoded stereotypes of masculinity that are associated with violence. Outmoded is a word you'll see frequently in academic writing about masculinity. So-called experts talk about manhood like it was last year's fad, in part because they subscribe to convenient but discredited blank slate theories about gender being, quote, "as lightly linked to sex as are the clothing, manners, and the form of headdress that a society at a given period assigns to either sex," end quote. Both men and women have attempted to refashion men to suit their dream of a perfect world. No matter what creed they profess, whether they want to make democratic men or fierce gentlemen, or inner warriors, they can't seem to escape the gravitational pull of some basic ideas about the underlying religion of men. To appeal to men, they speak of strength and courage. The moralizers and the reimaginers of masculinity play on a man's primal concern with his status within the male group, concern for his reputation, his distaste for being seen as weak, fearful, or inept. They appeal to his sense of honor. Their moralized and reimagined interpretations of strength and courage are simply tamed and pacified versions of the old gang virtues, suited to civilized life in a time of peace, plenty, and the sharing of political and economic power with women. To protect and serve their own interests, the wealthy and privileged have used feminists and pacifists to promote a masculinity that has nothing to do with being good at being a man, and everything to do with being what they consider a good man. Their version of a good man is isolated from his peers, emotional, effectively impotent, easy to manage, and tactically inept. A man who is more concerned with being a good man than being good at being a man makes a very well-behaved slave. There has always been a push and pull between civilized virtues and tactical gang virtues. However, the kind of masculinity acceptable to civilized societies is in many cases related to survival band masculinity. Civilized masculinity requires male gang dramas to become increasingly controlled, vicarious, and metaphorical. Human societies start with the gang, and then grow into nations with sports and a climate of political, artistic, and ideological competition. Eventually, as we see today, average men end up with economic competition and a handful of masturbatory outlets for their caged manhood. When a civilization fails, gangs of young men are there to scavenge its ruins, mark new perimeters, and restart the world. Thug Life, the Story of Rome. Quote, "Remove justice, and what are kingdoms but gangs of criminals on a large scale? What are criminal gangs but petty kingdoms? A gang is a group of men under command of a leader, bound by a compact of association, in which the plunder is divided according to an agreed convention. If this villainy wins so many recruits from the ranks of the demoralized that it acquires territory, establishes a base, captures cities and subdues people, then it openly arrogates itself the title of kingdom, which is conferred on it, in the eyes of the world, not by the renouncing of aggression, but by the attainment of impunity." End quote. St. Augustine, City of God, 4-4. As the story goes, Rome was founded by a gang. The Romans believed that Romulus and Remus were the distant descendants of Aeneas, who wandered the Mediterranean with a small band of survivors after the ruin of Troy. These exiled Trojans, the few remaining ambassadors of a proud but defeated tradition, were guided by the gods to Latium, where they intermingled with the Latin people of Italy. The former Trojans thrived there and founded the settlement of Alba Longa, just southeast of modern Rome. Many generations passed, and the eldest son of each king took the throne until Amulius ousted his older brother Numitor. Amulius murdered Numitor's sons and forced his daughter, Rei Silvia, to become a Vestal Virgin, assuring that the exiled Numitor would have no heirs to challenge his own. However, Rei gave birth to twin boys, and rather than admit an indiscretion, she claimed that they were fathered by Mars, the god of war. King Amulius didn't buy her story. He had her chained and ordered her sons to be drowned in the Tiber River. The men charged with this task left the boys exposed in a swampy shallows of the flooded river and assumed the current would carry them to their deaths. According to legend, it was there that they were rescued by a thirsty she-wolf and suckled on her hairy dugs. The grandsons of Numitor were then discovered by shepherds who took the boys in and raised them as their own. Thanks in part to a vigorous country life, Romulus and Remus grew into strong young men known for hunting and for fearlessly confronting wild beasts. They also gained a reputation for attacking robbers, taking their loot and sharing it with all of their shepherd pals. The generous twins were also fun to be around, and their merry band grew. During a festival, they were ambushed by bitter robbers, and Remus was brought before the King Amulius on poaching charges. While Remus was in custody, Numitor suspected who the twins really were. Meanwhile, Romulus organized his band of shepherds to kill Amulius and free his brother. The shepherds entered the city separately and gathered together at the last moment to overwhelm Amulius's guard. Romulus succeeded in killing the tyrant king, and after learning his true heritage, he restored the kingship to his grandfather Numitor. The reunited twins then decided to found a city together on the land where they were raised. However, the two men quarreled over its naming, and the dispute became heated. The brothers challenged each other, and in the end, Romulus triumphed, killing his beloved twin brother. Romulus and his friends then set to work organizing the government of the new city that bore his name. According to the historian Livy, one of the first things that Romulus did after making some rudimentary fortifications was to establish the religious rites that would be celebrated by the people of Rome. In addition to the rites honoring the local gods, Romulus chose to observe the Greek rites of the heroic god-man Hercules, known for his great strength and for his virtuous deeds. After identifying a constellation of gods and setting up a rough spiritual course for his tribe, Romulus advertised the city of Rome as an asylum, where all men, freeborn or slave, could start a new life. A collection of immigrants from neighboring tribes traveled to Rome, and he selected the best men to help him rule. These men were made senators and designated fathers, patres, of the Roman tribe. Their heirs would be known as patricians. With the city fathers, he created order through law. Lacking women, the men of Rome knew their city would die with them. Romulus sent out envoys to surrounding communities to secure wives for his men. Their offers of marriage were refused, however, because the young men of Rome had no prospects, no reputations, and were generally regarded as a dangerous band of low-born men. Insulted, Romulus and his men hatched a scheme, and invited the people of neighboring communities to a festival. During the festival, they seized the unmarried girls. Their parents were furious, and the other tribes affected made war with Rome, but Rome prevailed over all militarily, except for the Sabines, with whom the women themselves helped make peace to save both their fathers and their new husbands. The Sabines decided to join the Romans, and it was through this successful rape of the Sabine women that Romulus ensured the future of his new tribe. Romulus continued to strengthen and defend his tribe through calculated military action, and he was loved by the rank and file of his men-at-arms. These rough men, Romulus's big gang, secured the city and made its growth possible. They were Rome's guardian class, and their unbeatable fighting spirit would characterize the Roman people for centuries. One day, as he prepared to review his troops, Romulus disappeared with a violent clap of thunder. Livy suspected that he was torn apart at the hands of his senators, who were contentious and tended to conspire, as men close to power often do. The Roman people preferred to remember Romulus as a great man of divine lineage, who lived among the people as one of them, who was known for his meritorious works and courage in battle, and who finally took his rightful place among the gods. There are many founding myths of cities, and countless myths that establish a totemic lineage of a particular people. In the absence of certain recorded history, this is the myth that Romans chose to believe about themselves. It is the spirit of the tale that endures, and it can tell us something about the way of men. Romulus and Remus were betrayed and abandoned. They were left to die and saved by a wolf. Livy admits that the wolf might easily have been a country whore, but it doesn't really matter. They were raised wild. Romulus and Remus were raised country. They had practical know-how, and they knew the value of a day's work. They were given a simple upbringing, uncomplicated by court politics or the soft moral equivocation that attends urban commerce. They were virile and upright youth. The early life of Romulus and Remus is a Robin Hood story. They roughed up other men, seized their stolen loot, and shared it with their poor friends. They were alpha males, natural leaders of men. They were tough, but they weren't bullies. They were the kind of men who other men look up to and want to be around. They were the kind of guys who men choose to lead of their own free will. They had heroic qualities, but they were as flawed as any men. And when the brothers fought for status, as brothers often do, one of them had to lose. Romulus's merry men were basically a gang. They were a rowdy bunch of country boys who came out of nowhere to attack a king and upset the status quo. When Romulus staked out his territory and announced that it would be an asylum, he attracted hooligans with little money or status of their own. Some were former slaves. Some could have been wanted men. They had little to lose, everything to gain, and no real investment in the communities they came from. Rome was Deadwood. It was the Wild West. Romulus organized these unruly men and established a hierarchy. He founded a culture, a religion, a group identity. Like any bunch of young men, Romulus's thugs had reproductive interests. Romulus tried the nice route, sending ambassadors out to inquire about getting his men some wives, but his men were laughed out of town. No father of means was going to send his daughter out to some camp to marry a man with no prospects. So Romulus took the women. The Romans were able to keep the women and start new families because they were strong and effective fighters. They didn't give in. They fought for a new future, and they won. The Roman tribe used violence and cunning to expand its borders, and men from many tribes became Romans. The expansion of Rome served the interests of the descendants of the tribal fathers, the patrician class. However, Roman economic and military power also benefited many other citizens and non-citizens living within Roman territory. Protected by Roman might, men were able to specialize and live their lives as laborers, craftsmen, farmers, and traders. Many men were able to live relatively non-violent lives. The Roman definition of manliness expanded to include ethical virtues that were less specifically male, but more harmonious with a more complex civilization. However, the Romans who rested in the lap of protection still hungered for the drama of violence. They became spectators of violence and blood sport. Gladiators fought each other to the death to entertain the Roman tribe. And the people crowded into massive stadiums like the Circus Maximus to watch chariot races highlighted by gory wrecks. There were chariot racing color gangs who brawled after the events like today's soccer hooligans. Political figures, landowners, and merchants employed gangs of armed young men to intimidate their opponents, tenants, and business rivals. Rome was founded by a gang, and it behaved like a gang. To paraphrase St. Augustine It acquired territory, established a base, captured cities, and subdued people. Then it openly arrogated itself the title of empire, which was conferred on it in the eyes of the world not by the renouncing of aggression, but by the attainment of temporary impunity. Rome slowly collapsed from the inside as it became a giant, pointless, corrupt economic machine. The Roman machine, like the American economic machine, could no longer embody the virile ethos of the small bands of rebellious men responsible for its creation. Gangs of armed young men existed throughout its rise and fall, and there were gangs long after the glory of Rome was left in ruin. The story of Rome is the story of men and civilization. It shows men who have no better prospects gathering together, establishing hierarchies, staking out land, and using their strength to assert their collective will over nature, women, and other men. A check to civilization. What are men supposed to do when there's no land to settle and no one to fight? One of the basic ideas of evolutionary psychology is that because human evolution occurred over a very long period of time, and then an explosion of technology thrust us into the modern world in a comparatively short period of time, recorded history, humans are more adapted physically and psychologically to the world as it was than they are to the world as it is today. Our minds and bodies are adapted to function in a harder world. The situations that make us happy, depressed, or afraid have some sort of relationship to our ability to function in what some call the environment of evolutionary adaptedness. The choices we make in the modern world may seem illogical, but they reflect the kinds of choices we would have made to survive thousands of years ago. Think of all the time, energy, and resources we spend on sex, even when we have no intention of reproducing. Logic's got nothing to do with it. Our primal bodies and minds still make their calculations based on the old data. Maybe this is a bug, or maybe it's a feature, just in case shit goes down. The first job of men has always been to keep the perimeter, to face danger, to hunt and fight. Men gather in bands and form a strong group identity. Men run through this pattern over and over again, whether it's logical or not. Drawing on their understanding of primates, evolutionary biologists Richard Wrangham and Dale Peterson came up with a theory about male gang behavior they dubbed, perhaps unflatteringly, male demonism. Quote, demonic males gather in a small, self-perpetuating, self-aggrandizing bands. They sight or invent an enemy over there, across the ridge, on the other side of the boundary, on the other side of a linguistic or social or political or ethnic or racial divide. The nature of the divide hardly seems to matter. What matters is the opportunity to engage in the vast and compelling drama of belonging to the gang, identifying the enemy, going troll, and participating in the attack. End quote. Calling this phenomenon demonism puts an immoral spin on our species' basic survival strategy. It's a strategy that worked for us for a very long time, and a strategy that we'd snap back to in an emergency. But once you've founded Rome, what then? Sometimes there is a good reason to make war, to identify them and mobilize our men against theirs. Sometimes there isn't. Every generation of young men can't be guaranteed a great crisis or war simply to give them an opportunity to explore their demonic primal nature or give their lives a sense of meaning. Starting wars for the sake of narrative seems frivolous, though I wonder if we do it subconsciously out of sheer boredom. Sometimes men pick fights just for something to do, just to feel something, like the threat of harm and the possibility of triumph. Most of the time, men seek out substitutes for fighting. In tribal societies, this was probably easy enough. Hunting is something like fighting, and that's why men still do it, even though they don't have to. Play fighting, sparring, is part of learning to fight, and men ritualize play fighting with sport. In 1906, William James called for a moral equivalent of war, question of whether war is moral or immoral. The phrase moral equivalent of war captures our need to suppress and redirect primal masculinity in peacetime. James acknowledged that men seemed to be perpetually in want of some campaigning way of life. As a pacifist, he suggested that all young men should be drafted for a certain period in a war against nature, where they could toil and suffer together as fishermen, coal miners, robe builders, and so forth. The idea of a war on nature wouldn't play very well today, but if it were tweaked a bit, it might be the most honest and realistic way to reimagine masculinity. James laughed at the now vindicated fears of his contemporaries who believed that without a sufficiently warlike nationalism, the United States would degenerate into a society, quote, of clerks and teachers, of co-education and zoophily, of consumer leagues and associated charities, of industrialism unlimited, and feminism unabashed, end quote. However, he also warned that, quote, a permanently successful peace economy cannot be a simple pleasure economy, end quote. William James's plan for peace might have worked for a while, though I doubt any plan for peace is viable in the long term. The problem with outlawing violence is that doing so requires violence, and the problem with outlawing war is that doing so requires universal simultaneous agreement to outlaw war. Otherwise, the peaceful doves end up sitting ducks. Whether it would have worked or not, men were never shipped off to fight a war against nature. But we still keep ourselves engaged with equivalents of war. Like energy, gang masculinity isn't created or destroyed. This demonism is part of what men are and what they're evolved to do. It's always there. It just takes on different forms. If a civilization is to grow and prosper, the tendency of men to break into gangs becomes an internal security threat. Gangs of men always pose a threat to established interests. Equivalents of gang masculinity have the potential to keep men invested in a given society and to keep them from tearing it apart. Viable substitutes for the masculine campaigning way of life keep men from asserting their own interests over the interests of the whole, or of those in power. When men are materially invested in society, when they believe there is more of what they want to gain by working for the group than by working against it, men will control and redirect their energies in the service of a prosperous society. When men are emotionally invested in a society, when they feel a strong connection to the group, a sense of us, men will control and redirect their energies in the service of a peaceful society as long as the most aggressive men, the men who are better at being men, are provided with desirable equivalents to gang aggression. As prosperity and security increase, the need for men to hunt, struggle, and fight decreases. The male desire to engage in gang activity can be controlled and channeled through simulation, vicariousness, and intellectualization. These three channels for the energy of gang masculinity are presented below in bullet points under the three headings. Heading 1. Simulated Masculinity. Point 1. Primal gang aggression and gang bonding are directly simulated through participation in military service, police service, and similar guardian activities. Point 2. Primal gang aggression and gang bonding are experienced through participation in ritualized and symbolic gang activities like team sports or cooperative gaming. Point 3. Primal aggression, competitiveness, and the need to prove masculinity to the group are channeled through participation in individual sports, survival games, or individual competitions that require demonstrations of strength, courage, or mastery. Heading 2. Vicarious Masculinity. Point 1. Males watch other males participate in wars, guardian work, and survival games. Point 2. Males watch other males participate in team sports or individual sports. Point 3. Males watch other males demonstrate strength, courage, mastery, or honor. Point 4. Males study the history of males who participated in wars, guardian work, survival games, who participated in team or individual sports, or who have demonstrated strength, courage, mastery, or honor. Point 5. Males read literature and stories about males who participate in wars, guardian work, and survival games, who participate in team or individual sports, or who have demonstrated strength, courage, mastery, or honor. Point 6. Males watch films or plays about males who participate in wars, guardian work, and survival games, who participate in team or individual sports, or who have demonstrated strength, courage, mastery, or honor. Heading 3. Intellectualized Masculinity. Point 1. Economic aggression and gang activity. Men or groups of men compete to outwit each other through economic competition. They demonstrate strength and courage by testing each other to see who is going to back down first and who is going to press his interests furthest. One example is a commissioned salesman selling an automobile to an informed buyer. Economic masculinity is demonstrated by taking risks and believing that you are competent enough to prevail. Companies benefit from intellectualized masculinity when men are more productive because they are encouraged to compete against each other. Point 2. Political, ideological aggression, and gang activity. Men form political or ideological teams and compete to win debates and battles of wit and strategy. Examples include political strategy, philosophical debate, academic or scientific debate, religious debate, and the guys who spend hours on message boards and comment threads trying to prove they are right about almost anything. Point 3. Metaphorical masculinity. For religious, ideological, and personal reasons, men turn masculinity inward. External battles become metaphors for internal battles, and the focus is on self-mastery, impulse control, disciplined behavior, and perseverance. Men struggle to be good men, to be rational men, to be good fathers, to be good citizens, to be faithful men, to invent and create, to achieve goals. Finally, ascetic masculinity. The self-mastery and self-discipline of metaphorical masculinity lead to a tunneled focus on self-denial and the rejection of natural male desires for sex, food, worldly things, virile action, or violence. This is the end of the list. I first envisioned simulated, vicarious, and intellectual masculinity as a progression running in one direction. My thinking was that as societies become safer and more prosperous, masculinity is simulated, then mostly vicarious, then mostly intellectualized. That makes some sense.